This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. Today is the Friday recap where we revisit a few of the most interesting conversations we had this week. Up first, we'll hear from someone working on the next season of Que Pasa Midwest, a bilingual podcast for Indiana's Latino community. We're joined now by Maria Thomas, Director of Digital Media at WNIN. Welcome, Maria.
Thank you.
You've been interacting with students about the podcast and some of the issues you cover. Can you talk about how that got started?
Yes. So for season six, we covered COVID, recovering from COVID. And we have a member on our community advisory board who works at one of the local universities, the University of Evansville, Erin Lewis. And she told us that there was a change maker class and the students were going to be coordinating with a local church to do a vaccine clinic after the mass. And so we coordinated with them to also attend this clinic and do interviews and find out why people decided to get vaccinated or not get vaccinated and how, you know, they felt about it. And since I personally am not fully bilingual, I actually partnered up with the students to translate for me. They were doing a project where they wanted to find out about healthcare in the community. And of course, we were talking about the importance of the vaccine and recovering from COVID. And so we wanted to just get people's views on that. So the students were amazing at translating. And one of them in particular was really great at actually coming up with her own follow-up questions based off the responses of the people we were talking to. So that was really an amazing experience that kind of started it all. That was Cindy Crow's class at the University of Evansville.
And so what kind of classes have you been talking to? Is it just students that were in Cindy's class?
No, so we've been talking to a couple of classes over the years, high schools and colleges. It's been Spanish classes, media classes, communication classes, business classes, things like that. And depending on what type of class we talk to, that just changes, you know, what aspect of the podcast do we talk about. So with the Spanish classes, we usually talk about the mix of English and Spanish, since the podcast is bilingual and why we chose to make it that way. And then we talk a little bit about how we reach out to the communities and the importance of gaining the trust of people and making them feel comfortable before you start talking to them about really kind of personal things like the healthcare, which is why we decided to partner up with the students, because talking to someone about their healthcare and their views on healthcare it's kind of invasive. And mm-hmm. so I didn't want to add in a language barrier on top of that.
Well, Sorry.
I was going to say, for the business and communication classes, we just kind of talk about the process of making a podcast usually.
What has the overall response been like from students?
They've been amazing. They have a lot of questions usually, and they seem really interested in the podcast itself. We've had a few people interested in becoming interns for the podcast after we've done the presentations with their classes, and I'm looking forward to working with them next semester.
When you mentioned some of the students came up with their own follow-up questions, I was wondering, are these journalists in the making?
That's what I was thinking. She wasn't a journalism major, but I told her, I was like, hey, those follow-up questions are really good. Like, you're a natural. You should think about this.
Yeah. Well, was there a specific episode or topic that you've seen get a big reaction from students?
I think it would have been, we did two episodes from the vaccine clinic. And so, of course, those students were very invested in it. And then also we talked to a Spanish class about the census episode, filling out the census. And they were really interested in it. It was about identity, really, because when you go to fill out the census, it wants to know, like, you know, your race and ethnicity. And for me, it wasn't too hard. I'm Black, so that was easy to mark for me. But then for Paola, it was a little difficult because she's Caribbean and she speaks Spanish, so she's Hispanic. And like her identity is like, it's hard to put it in a box, you know? People aren't boxes. So we just talked about the complexity of identity, of being multicultural and things like that. And the students were really interested in them. And one of the students in the classes had the same issue. And we talked to them about the importance of filling out the census and, you know, had they done it before? Do they understand what it does for their communities? So that was a conversation we had recently, and that was really cool.
Yeah, I can imagine that it's a roadblock to fill out the census if you can't find any representation on there. It makes you feel like, why bother?
Exactly. Yeah.
with regards to what you took away from listening to students, is there something that you learned that surprised you or just something new?
Just they were curious. One of the things that has been big is source diversity, and so they were curious about how we find our sources. And a lot of times it starts with people you know, and then leaders in the community. And we've been working to diversify our sources so we're not going back to the same person over and over again. And so their questions just made me think more about that. And for this season, for season 7, John Auerbach and Steve Berger right now are in Nebraska. So like that's diversity in terms of states that we've been covering. They're currently working on an episode or two out there.
That's really cool. So it's expanding.
Yes.
Is there something about the podcast format you think is really effective for schools?
I think it is just the range of topics that get covered and the conversational nature of it. Yes, there are some serious topics that are covered, but we try to make everything relatable by having the story of a person who's gone through it. And we didn't want it to be too NPR, like, too reporty, I guess you could say. I'm using real great words for a communication specialist. but yeah, we just wanted it to be something that is easy to listen to. So it's pretty short. 15 minutes is about the max for an episode. And we just try to make sure that we have a nice mixture of facts and statistics along with the dialogue, the conversation with the people that we talk to.
When it comes to working on stories, I think journalists oftentimes get sort of isolated by working on something and then jumping to the next story, the next story. What is the value, do you think, or is there a value in doing this kind of a long-term engagement with the community?
Yes, I am so happy that we are at this point in time now where we are doing this community engagement because for me, when we go out and talk to these people, I feel connected to them, especially when you're talking about things that are so personal and, to them and just in general. And so now being able to partner with these classes and actually make a change for the people that we're talking to has been so amazing. And I'm really looking forward to seeing what we can do in the future. We've talked to another professor at the University of Evansville-Lorena, who is going to have a medical Spanish class. And after we did that vaccine clinic and saw the impact that it had, we were thinking about what more can we do? So the university has a like a clinic that they have that goes out into community, and we're thinking about how we can partner with the Spanish students in this clinic and just everything. There's a joint medical school in Evansville. So there's a lot to look forward to. And I really think that when you make media that can make change in the community, that's really something special.
Being able to bring people together and to provide information and resources is awesome. And how do you get to that level where you have been able to earn trust in the community that you're covering?
For us, having a native Spanish speaker was the number one thing. And then moving on from there, as I mentioned before, just really making connections with people that are trusted in the community. So in the case of the vaccine clinic, we talked to the priest of that church, and he made an announcement after church saying, "Hey, these people are here, the medical people are here to give you vaccines. I got my vaccine." He actually lost his dad to coronavirus. So for him, it was really important that he protect the people that, he's serving in his parish. And he also said, and on top of these people being here for the vaccine clinic, we have some students and our local NPR station here to talk to you about it. So having someone that they look up to and trust say, "Hey, these people are here and it's okay and you can trust them," really helped us out a lot. And he even came up after and helped us find people to talk to because it is scary when there's a microphone and all this equipment in your face. He's like, "Hey, these are my friends. Like, do you want to talk to them? Just answer a few questions." So things like that are really helpful.
Have you seen a change overall in the community's response to the work that you're doing?
I think more people are aware of it now. It's always been positive and has continued to be a positive response, but it's really cool to go out into like, oh, Gabe Ossipit West to get to that point.
Yeah. Well, is there an overall focus for season seven of the podcast?
Yes, so season seven is taking a look at how rights are applied to citizens versus non-citizens with a specific focus on the Bill of Rights. And so we're going to be looking into a case. What John and Steve are doing is a case study in Nebraska based on two communities, and then or on a community, and then looking at the regional area. And then we have April Alonzo in Cicero, Illinois, who will be comparing two communities and the res who have a similar demographic makeup, and just kind of like the resources they have in each community. And how things have been different in certain cases.
Before we let you go, can you give us a quick few sentences or so about what why it's important to have this kind of a resource, a bilingual podcast?
So representation is important, and that is such an understatement. And especially now, having or in the past two seasons in a pandemic. We saw how important it is to get information to people and not have barriers, not have a language barrier or a barrier of like media or whatever it is. So the thing about the podcast is that it is digital. It can reach people where they are on whatever device they're using on many different platforms. And then, of course, it is important to know your rights. So season seven, that's kind of a little bit of what we're looking at. And having them explain to you in your language is very important because once again, it's all about removing barriers and increasing understanding.
And that's Maria Thomas, Director of Digital Media at WNIN in Evansville. Just ahead, we'll learn about systemic issues in the world of professional baseball. A reminder, this show is not live. I'm Miriam Soap. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soap. And it's the Friday recap where we revisit some of our conversations from this past week. A reminder, this show is not live. The working conditions for minor league baseball players are making headlines as players have started opening up about facing financial hardship and housing insecurity. We'll hear the conversation we had with Harry Marino, Executive Director for Advocates for Minor Leaguers, and Kieran Lovegrove, career minor league pitcher for the Rocket City Trash Pandas in Alabama. Harry, we're touching on the antitrust laws and the relationship with Major League Baseball. Can you give us a quick summary of what exactly this all means?
Yeah, absolutely. So back in 1922, the Supreme Court said that baseball was not subject to the same anti-monopoly laws that apply to every other industry in the United States. And the real reason for that is archaic, but basically at this point, nobody agrees that it's a good decision. And since 1922, a lot has changed, and every other sports league has been subject to those anti-monopoly laws. What that means in practice is that major league owners can sit around a table, draft up minor league players, decide how to treat them, decide how much to pay them, decide how long their contract should be, and agree not to compete for each other's players. So take someone like Kieran, very talented baseball player. He gets drafted by a team. You know, they decide we're only going to pay Kieran $500 a week. In a normal industry where the antitrust laws applied, that wouldn't work because another team would come in and say, hey, Kieran, you're only making $500 a week, you know, playing for the Angels. If you come and play in the Mets system, we'll give you $1,000 a week. That basic competition for services is so important for workers to recoup the actual value that they are providing to their employers. I mean, that's what the basic, you know, free market system that our country operates on is based on. And workers in every other industry get that, but workers in the minor league, in baseball, and specifically minor league players, don't get a fair market for their services. And so, you know, a lot of times people have said, wow, minor leaguers are treated poorly. We should give them, you know, the minimum wage at least to me, I kind of reject that premise because minor league players on an open market would make way, way more than the minimum wage. They are providing tremendous value to their employers, both as prospective major league players and also as, you know, current minor league players who are performing in front of fans at a high level every day. And so, you know, it's a little bit of a hidden secret here that, you know, people don't know about, but this antitrust exemption, it's really pernicious. And it really is a big reason why minor leaguers are subjected to this extraordinarily depressed wage.
It's interesting that this was put together and hasn't been challenged, it sounds like, and it's just kind of swept under the rug.
Yeah, I mean, look, the way the Supreme Court works is once a decision is made, it's a really, really high bar to overturn it based upon, you know, the concept of precedent and stare decisis. And so what we have is a situation where the Supreme Court said something, you know, 100 years ago, and it stood for 100 years. There's going to be a really high bar to overturn it. I will say that there is growing optimism about the Supreme Court actually doing so. And that relates to the Supreme Court case this past spring, NCAA versus Alston, where the court basically opened up the gateway for college athletes to start making money off their name, image, and likeness. In that opinion, the Supreme Court cited a brief that we submitted, our organization, Advocates for Minor Leaguers, talking about baseball's exemption. And in doing so, the court actually mentioned the exemption in a way that really cast some doubt on it. It said this is a so-called exemption, and it really hasn't made a lot of sense. And so that's a signal, you know, for lawyers out there that maybe there is an opportunity to go after that antitrust exemption, you know, and maybe the Supreme Court, the current court, you know, the current nine members of the court, at least, have an appetite for reconsidering that antitrust exemption, because you won't be able to find one lawyer out there who can explain to you why it makes a bit of sense. It just doesn't. And at a certain point, the fact that things have always been a certain way is not a very good justification for the kind of real world hardship that players like Kieran and thousands of others have endured for decades.
Kieran, what was it like for you when you got drafted and started your career in the minor leagues? Did you ever at a time feel like this isn't what you thought you signed up for?
Yeah, I think there were definitely times in my career where I looked around and said, this doesn't feel right to me. This doesn't feel like presenting an opportunity for players to better themselves and ultimately create an organization that is more likely to win baseball games. You know, my personal experience, I was not someone who was drafted in the lower rounds, so I actually got a good signing bonus. And, you know, I didn't have to struggle for the first few years. I was able to rent my own apartments. I was able to eat what I wanted. And I very quickly realized how much money that hemorrhages when your paychecks coming in to replace it are so little. And I started hemorrhaging through that money very quickly as a young, you know, 17, 18, 19, 20-year-old with very little financial literacy. You know, I started realizing that this is extremely difficult to do if you're not someone who was paid a few hundred thousand dollars out of the draft. And the vast majority of players who come into minor league baseball are not paid more than $100,000 for their signing bonus. And then obviously you have taxes on top of that. So a lot of guys, that initial signing bonus goes straight into a savings account because it's all you have for the next 7 years if you don't make the big leagues.
And that's got to be hard, I'm guessing, because you're working full time in this field. Is there even time to get a second job?
So during the season, no. During spring, no. And during the fall, if you're in instructs, no. Most of the time, if you get a secondary job, it's a seasonal job that runs somewhere from September, October to right around February. A lot of guys do Lyft and Uber, or they work retail, or they work in warehouses. I've done all three of those things throughout my career. And the biggest issue is the jobs that are available or the hours that you have to work aren't necessarily conducive to your training schedule. And so it becomes very difficult to balance that, you know, training at an elite level, making sure that your body is in the right spot, making sure you're able to eat enough food to maintain your weight and your muscle mass and recover. And also going into work 8-10 hours a day, putting that strain on your body and you know, doing that just so you can keep your head above water so that you can afford the food that you need to eat to recover for the job that you're training for. It kind of becomes this vicious cycle of money in, money out, just to maintain the ability to play the game.
Have you heard from any major league players that are supportive of your cause, of bringing attention to this?
Yes, absolutely. I think probably one of the most prominent ones is Sean Doolittle. He has been a voice for positivity in the game for a long time. And he has continued to step up and support the movement. And there have been others, Jose Ramirez, Chris Taylor, they've worn the Fairball wristbands. Trey Mancini, I could go on and on. There are a lot of players who support this because there are a lot of players who have lived that reality in the minor leagues and have seen teammates, friends. I mean, these players and these teammates become like a family to you. And to watch them have to suffer through poor wages and not being able to see their family and having to eat, you know, less than quality food, and seeing that effect on their mental health, I think that has a pretty profound effect on most players, because it shouldn't be that way if we're trying to create a team or an organization that is that has the goal of winning in mind.
It's got to be complicated, too. I'm thinking of the relationships where, you know, you have a teammate that goes on to the major league and they're getting paid much more and they're remembering where they came from. But at the same time, I'm guessing there's going to be guilt to be moving up and then everybody else is still getting paid really basic.
I personally wouldn't know. You know what I can say just from having a free agent deal. So after your 7 years of minor league contract, you're able to sign free agent minor league deals, which you can substantially increase your pay. Of course, it takes 7 years to do so. And there were times even when I was receiving substantially more than the other players on my team because I was on a free agent deal. And if I wasn't performing, I felt guilt during that time, because I almost didn't feel like I was worthy of that pay just because of what we've been so conditioned to. When one player is getting $1,500 a month and one player is getting almost $20,000 a month to be on the same team, that discrepancy can be a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine that that's not a good feeling. Harry, you also played in the minor league for a couple of years. What was your experience like?
Yeah, so listen, my experience, and this was a little while ago, but 2012 through 2014, was consistent with, you know, Kieran's and so many other guys over the past few decades. I mean, I saw all of the same types of things firsthand, whether it was players, you know, struggling with housing, with meals, with, you know, making ends meet. You know, I've told this story before, but I vividly remember walking into a teammate's apartment, and they had five air mattresses laid on the ground in a one-bedroom apartment. A pretty jarring thing to see, to be honest with you. Just not really a human way to live. I mean, honestly, I felt like those conditions were dehumanizing. And at the time, we were only, you know, 45 minutes up the road from the major league team, which was, you know, worth, you know, $2 billion. And I remember thinking, this just is not right on a fundamental level. Like, there are a lot of reasons why this shouldn't be happening from a performance standpoint, just from an economic standpoint. But in that moment, I remember feeling, this is just not morally okay. How are there people involved with this major league team that are okay with this happening down the road? Like, it just can't be the case. So it's really troubling. And, you know, I think something that is important to note is that the minor leagues are made up of a significant number of Latin American players, from Dominican Republic, from Venezuela, all manner of countries, a lot of very, very talented baseball players from that region who are signed and come to America to be a part of this system and are drastically underpaid. And there are a lot more Latin players, as many as there are in the major leagues, there are way more at the lower levels of the minor leagues. As you move up, levels, it gets, you know, whiter and whiter and whiter. And that also was really problematic to me, to see so many Latin American players who didn't speak the language, who didn't have any advocates for them, didn't have any union representing them, living five guys to a one bedroom apartment. It just felt like very, very exploitative. And it really, really bothered me.
You know, it's interesting. I was going to ask you about that, if there was sort of some kind of systemic problems within baseball that would lead to us saying that, you know, maybe there is a lot of exploitation at the lower levels because of the makeup of the team. Have you seen that changing over the years, or has it gotten worse?
So, you know, I'll give you an example, and it's not, unfortunately, a good answer. But so in minor league baseball, there's something called extended spring training, which is a period of from, you know, basically April until the draft in late June, when players who are not assigned out to a minor league team to go play games in front of fans stay back at the spring training facility and just train in the, you know, as they would during, you know, the off season and spring training, to just prepare for this season. Those players are, you know, the numbers are pretty drastic. There's a lot of Latin American players that are in that extended spring training setup. Historically, players at extended spring training don't receive any salary, even though they're working 6 days a week, going to the field, you know, all day, training, working out, playing, you know, all the whole nine. They don't receive any salary at all. And I can't help but think that part of the reason for that is that there are so many Latin American players who don't have a voice, who don't speak the language, who aren't going to speak up and complain about it. And to me, that has always been some of the most drastic exploitation in minor league baseball, because remember, you don't receive a salary all off season. So if you are one of these players who's assigned to extended spring training, you could go for an entire 12-month period, all of during which you are training, working for your employer, putting in hours to, you know, to try to become one of their major leaguers, and providing value to them in that way, you might only receive 3 months of pay. And that might amount to something like $3,000 for the entire year. And the fact that there are so many Latin American players in that situation, I think is something that is really, really problematic. And that Major League Baseball needs to take a hard look at.
Yeah, I mean, I'm honestly, I shouldn't say that I'm surprised, because nothing surprises me these days. But at the same time, I'm just speechless that this has been going on and nobody really knows about it.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the reason that people don't know about it is for so long there has been a culture of fear of speaking up. As Kieran said, there's a carrot out there, which is, one day I'll be able to make the major leagues and make it, you know, and become rich. And, you know, what they don't tell you is that's only going to happen for, you know, something like 10%, if that, of minor league players. For the vast, vast overwhelming majority of minor leaguers, that big payday is never going to come. And they're going to have been exploited as a result during their minor league years. And, you know, obviously something our organization exists to do is to embolden players to speak up, to draw attention to it. And, you know, I think it's worth mentioning that Kieran was one of the first players, if not the first player, to really put his name behind this and come out and say, this is how minor leaguers are treated. And it was so jarring that ESPN ran a story on it that was, you know, basically at the top of their page for a couple of days, because people were like, wow, they couldn't believe something that, you know, those of us inside the game have known for a long time. It's been a really, really well-kept secret, and it has taken players like Kieran and others who have been willing to buck that longstanding trend of staying silent in order to really start to raise awareness about it. And candidly, that's the only reason we're even on this show today having a conversation, is Kieran's bravery and the bravery of those like him who've said, it's time to stop suffering in silence. We have to draw attention to this, because anybody who hears what's really going on is not going to be happy about it, and is going to want to hold MLB to account, and is going to want to see some change. And, you know, a couple months later, we're starting to see that.
Well, Kieran, we have about a minute till we go to break. What was it that compelled you to speak up about this?
I think first and foremost, it is that deep kind of irrational love for the game. I got in about 10 years ago, and now coming out, realizing that the game hasn't really made any positive progress in that time, irked me a little bit. And seeing the next generation continually come in year after year, the new draftees, and seeing them come in kind of bright-eyed and with all this hope, and then to see that kind of get diminished year after year when they realize the realities of minor league baseball. Over time, that has really started to wear away at me and diminish my hope for the game. So now, moving forward, I just want to make sure that next generation is completely taken care of, that they don't have to deal with the same struggles that we've dealt with for 40 years.
And that was Kieran Lovegrove, career minor league pitcher for the Rocket City Trash Pandas in Alabama. We were also speaking with Harry Marino, executive director for Advocates for Minor Leaguers. Up next, how do you define success and make personal goals? That's coming up. I'm Miriam Soap. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soap, and it's the Friday Recap, where we look back at some of our favorite conversations this past week. For the final segment of today's show, we'll hear about the many ways people define success and get advice on working towards personal goals. With us are Joe Holt, a James E. Jack Teaching Professor of Business Ethics at the Mendoza College of Business at the University of Notre Dame, and Nate Cornell, a professor of psychology at Williams College in Massachusetts. Living our lives for the anonymous crowd out there is something that a lot of people struggle with. Is this a result of social media, or have we always had this tendency to look for validation from outsiders?
Joe? I think it's both. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead. Either one.
Nate, you go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's both. I think there's this concept of the what they call the hedonic treadmill, where no matter how good things get, it's kind of like you're running in place and you just get used to whatever you have and then you just want more. You know, so you could, I mean, there's this great quote in this book by Michael Lewis. I forget which one, but it's basically this guy who's making $1 million a year. And he's like, there's no way I could survive on $800,000 a year at this point. And I'm sitting there like, what? Like, are you on Earth? So, but the thing is, that's actually, it's laughable and you want to make fun of him, but that's the reality of human existence, is that it's hard not to want more all the time. Yeah. And so that's what we end up doing. And, you know, if you can find a way to like be satisfied with what you have, that's when you can't get to the goal if your goal is to always be better. That's mm-hmm. not a goal you can achieve. Only maybe Michael Jordan achieved it in the NBA, but that's about it. You can achieve feeling satisfied with your life if you say to yourself, okay, look how well you're doing. You've reached the goal. Now stop changing the goal. Don't move the goalposts. Let's be happy with what we got. You know, and you don't want to do that and then stop putting effort into your work or into your family life or the other things you care about. Because if you stop doing that, then you're not going to feel competent anymore. But you can also have both, I think.
So I agree with all of that on hedonic adaptation. I think the other powerful force that goes on is social comparison, where we kind of judge ourselves as doing well or not, not by looking at what we have, but by looking at what we have in comparison with what some other relevant group has. So, you know, I was a corporate attorney, and we got a raise, almost doubled our salary within 2 years, but we didn't consider ourselves in comparison with the average salary in America. We did in comparison with how much the partners were making, and then we were miserable. So the Dalai Lama said we have the comparing mind. We don't look at what we have and give thanks. We look at what we don't have and regret it. But on social comparison, H.L. Mencken back in early 20th century defined success as making $100 a year more than your wife's sister's husband.
Yeah, which is true.
Right. It's social comparison. On the adaptation piece, too, it's interesting. The economist at USC, Richard Easterlin, wrote this really interesting essay explaining happiness. And he said there are different dimensions of well-being, monetary and non-monetary. So non-monetary is, you know, your health, close relationships, meaning work, et cetera. And he said within each dimension, we have on the one hand a level of aspiration where we want to be, on the other hand, level of attainment where we are. And he posited that happiness increases when you narrow the gap between aspiration and attainment. But he said the interplay of those two is different in the non-monetary dimensions, because in monetary dimension, you know, if you get a raise, so your level of attainment goes up, does your level of aspiration stay the same? And I think the indications are no, it goes up at the same time and to about the same extent. So you never really narrow the gap. Just like you can go further down your wish list of stuff you'd like to buy because you got more money. But when it comes to, you know, non-monetary dimensions, like, you know, finding a great friendship, when you find, you think about your best friend. When you find that friend, do you find yourself wondering, well, you know, so she's really amazing, but I wonder if I could find an even better best friend. No, you just kind of give thanks. So when it comes to those dimensions, we really do experience an increase in happiness and well-being when we narrow the gap. But his point is that Americans in general spend too much time on the monetary dimension and end up unsatisfied and ought to be devoting more time and energy to the non-monetary dimensions, like your physical health, close relationships, meaningful work, all of that.
And I would say that the pandemic kind of exacerbated that, didn't it? Didn't it open people's eyes to that?
I think so. Absolutely. Yeah, life-shaking. Go ahead, Nate.
Oh, going back to your comment about the, you know, your initial question, I think one of the things the pandemic did was, for me personally, but I know this is a larger pattern as well. When I would go on Facebook or something like that and somebody was happy, I was like, ugh, barf. You know, I did not want to see that at all. I was like, I hope, because the thing is, I was not happy, you know, and I know that people in my family weren't happy. And so what you see, I mean, we all know this, what you see on Facebook is like, you take the 1 minute out of every 10 days that's the best part of your life, and you put that on Facebook or on Instagram or Snapchat or TikTok, whatever. And so we get this really false impression of what's going on with our friends. And so this social comparison thing becomes more toxic because instead of me comparing myself to my neighbor or my best friend and knowing what they're actually up to, I'm comparing myself to some idealized version. And I think with COVID, people kept doing that idealized version online,
right?
But in reality, you know, it was completely different. And so I know that the college students that I'm interacting with here at Williams, and I don't think it's limited to college students, but they are having a huge problem with this because nobody shares their darkest feelings and thoughts with the general population. And which is why actually as a good deed to society, I'm being totally sincere. I have actually been bringing people down by telling them, hey, I'm not doing that great. You know, like I'm having a rough week and stuff like that, just to kind of like balance the universe in terms of what is being put out there about mm-hmm. how other people are doing.
So when people ask how you're doing, you answer honestly?
That's great. Not when I'm passing them in the hall, but if they were sitting in chairs, then I do.
Okay. So I agree with all of that. It seems like, you know, social comparison has always been around, but with social media, it's like social comparison on steroids. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's interesting that in ethics now, the focus is on the question, what should I do? But at the beginning of ethics, the focus was on a wiser question, which is how should I live? And our answers to that, I think, you know, as you said, Miriam, everybody, you know, has their own definition or should have their own definition. But I think our answer to that question is driven by our sense of what most matters in life. And I think what the pandemic has done is caused a lot of people to rethink what does most matter in life, what is most important, and all of that. I had the experience of volunteering as a nurse's aide in an ICU when Chicago was a hot zone, working with only COVID patients. And saw a lot of that up close and personal. I took 13 bodies to the morgue myself. Saw a lot of death and a lot of really horrible suffering. And that changes what you think matters in life. And being alive matters. And being able to, you know, I didn't have a single patient who could get out of bed, who could eat, who could speak. So what I found is, on the one hand, it breaks your heart to see people suffering so much. On the other hand, it leads you to take extraordinary delight in ordinary pleasures. The fact that you can get out of bed, you can go out for a walk in the sunshine, you can go for a run, you can speak, you have a future you can think of, you know, all of that kind mm-hmm. of, you're not in pain, all of those kinds of things that I think a lot of us just take for granted.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it reminds me of a saying that I've heard often where, you know, whenever you're feeling down or not so great about your life, visit the hospitals, visit sick people.
Yeah.
And I think there's a second reason that's valuable. In addition to the fact that it gives you perspective, it's also when I ask students, because I teach classes about the psychology of success, and I ask students to write down, like, what are some of your goals or what are some of your successes in the past? And they're virtually 100% about myself. Mm-hmm. Like, what have I done? Which makes total sense, and I have no criticism. However, What that doesn't take into account is that for most people, actually one of the best feelings is when you help someone else. And you do it in a meaningful way, and you can tell that it made a difference. They don't have to thank you, but you can tell it made a difference. That is, if you really reflect on it, that's an amazing feeling. But it's not like nobody buys tickets for that. You go see the basketball game or you go to the movies. Yeah.
Right.
But helping people is free. You know, and in fact, even just giving compliments is free. And you know, these are things that if you start to do them, you know, it might be a little bit inauthentic at first, but it can become real. And those are the kind of goals that I think you look back on and you say, like, okay, I needed to find something in my life that would be more meaningful for me. So what I did is I went and helped people with something, and I can be proud of that no matter what.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's like the kind of advice that when I give this to college students, they're too busy. Like, they got other problems, so they can't really do it. But once you're feeling like a little bit more established in your life, maybe that's something you can do, as you, Joseph, obviously did by volunteering.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, it's interesting. John Stuart Mill and others have raised this question of, like, you know, who are the happiest people? And if you think about the absolute happiest people you know in life, and I don't mean tra-la-la happy, I mean, you know, joyful and at peace kind of people. Are they the people who are most focused on their own happiness? And in my experience, no. The people I know who are most focused on themselves are the most miserable people. I know. Yeah. The people I know who are happiest are in great relationships. And to Nate's point, I mean, they care about others. And they experience happiness as a byproduct of caring for others, not as what they are aiming at. You know, the other interesting thing on this me focus is I was teaching a seminar once, and about 25 students, and about 10 of them were married, and about 6 of them were parents. And I said, I'm going to throw out a word, and I want you to write down the three things that first come to mind. And the word I threw out was success. And they wrote things down. They handed them in. And what's interesting is not a single person who was married included being a good spouse. Not a single person who was a parent included being a good parent. Everything they wrote down had to do with career success. And there are people who love their spouses and love their children, but it's just when they think success, that's not what they think.
Wow. And, you know, I'm just thinking about that as is it a societal thing because we place so much emphasis on people's status and career and title?
Yeah. Well, think about in 2012 when Mitt Romney was running for president and he's criticized for being super wealthy and out of touch. And he said, I'm not going to apologize for being successful. What did he mean by that? He didn't mean that he has a great marriage and a great family. He meant that he made a lot of money. Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's just too narrow a definition, I think.
Yeah, and I think also going back to the idea of competence that we were talking about earlier and how important that is for psychological feelings of success, people don't feel like being a good, in my case, father, is a sign of competence, but it is. And I think that could actually, you know, as there are not very many things in life that where it's like happiness comes for free. That's really, really more optimistic than I want to be because I'm not really an optimist, but focusing your life a little bit more on like, hey, I did a good job talking to my daughter today. So that should give me a feeling of competence or, you know, those kind of feelings of competence can really be valuable and you earn them, you deserve them. But sometimes people don't sort of like take those rewards.
Yeah, I'm definitely taking notes here and be like, okay, the kids had breakfast and they made it to school this morning. I'm good.
Yeah. Yeah. I only cried twice.
There's an old Billy Joel song, Angry Young Man, and one of the lines is, I found that just surviving is a noble fight. I mean, during the pandemic, that's true.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's a success, getting through the day. We're all alive. We're healthy.
Yeah. Well, have views on success in America changed at all, do you think? Or is it still sort of this one view in our culture, Joe?
You know, I've been teaching for a long time, like since the 80s, and I love the millennials. The millennials get slammed a lot, but I say God bless the millennials. They give me more hope than I've ever had in my life, that things can be really, really different in terms of true happiness and work-life balance and gender equity and racial justice and all of that. I think there's a lot of stuff that people have put up with for years that they just won't put up with. And they want meaning in work and they want to work for companies that are making a positive difference and they want to find something they can put their heart into. I find a lot of wisdom in them. So I think with them, it really is changing in ways that, in my opinion, are more wise.
Nate, are Americans too focused on career success if we look at it from sort of a cultural perspective?
Yes, I think so. I mean, you know, and this is tricky because, you know, the United States has a huge GDP and we're a nation that's very powerful in the world, obviously. And, you know, at the same time, I'm like, let's all work less hours. Like, let's all go home early on Fridays, you know. And as a professor, you can kind of just goof around all the time. But I think a lot of people really have to work. And so decreasing the amount of work people do, I think, would be healthy. I think if you work too little, you don't feel the competence, and it's that's not good for you. But, you know, life is about priorities, especially when it comes to things like success. And if you want to ask the question, are we too focused on work in terms of what success is? Part of it comes down to what are we prioritizing in terms of our time? And also, here's the other thing. If you look at the United States compared to other countries with respect to levels of clinical measures of happiness, such as like levels of depression and anxiety, which are correlated with happiness. It's not the same thing. They're actually kind of high in the United States. And there's a really weird paradoxical thing that tends to be true. Even when things get worse in this country, like after 9/11, rates of suicide, depression, and anxiety actually leveled out or went down, because there was such a feeling of common cause and unity. And sometimes bad things that I absolutely 100% do not want to happen again, but they do have this paradoxical benefit. And there's something about modern society in the United States and other parts of the world that is also hurting us.
Well, we are about to wrap up. We have about a minute left. Joe, did you have anything you wanted to add on that point?
No, I had a friend whose father was a partner in a big accounting firm, and he had a rich and full life, very involved in his community and very involved in volunteering and running and traveling. And he once said, you know, there are partners who make more money than I do, and there are partners who have a bigger office than I do. And there are days when I envy them their bigger paycheck and bigger office, but I wouldn't trade the total package I have in life for anybody else's total package. So I think it's helpful to think about it in terms of your total package. There was a survey done a number of years ago asking people if they would accept 20% less pay to be able to spend 20% more time with their loved ones, and a lot of people said yes. So that's everybody got to find out what's the balance that works for you, but you know, get enough of everything you need.
Thank you so much to both of you for joining us. Joe Holt is a James E. Jack Teaching Professor of Business Ethics at the Mendoza College of Business at the University of Notre Dame. And Nate Cornell is a professor of psychology at Williams College in Massachusetts. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana, and you can always leave us a message at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soap. Thanks for listening. This is All In.